So I'm very excited to tell you all about some of the research that is going on in my lab today. I've really enjoyed this workshop. Thanks so much, Dan, for the invitation. It's been great to hear what other people are doing and to brainstorm about what cellular energetics are and what is unknown and what we can do in the future. And so today, what I wanted to do is talk at length about one project that is going on in my lab. But in the beginning, I will give you kind of a brief, hopefully brief introduction to various things that we work on in the lab, the majority of which is not the project that I'm going to be talking about. And so the kind of the observation that I'm really fascinated by, that I think driving many or most of the research in my lab, is this one of the observations anyways, is that these changes in energy metabolism can really have a dramatic effect on lifespan of many different organisms. So here you see, so this is data from rats. So reds are rats that always had food available in their cage. And then green are rats that are given exactly 40% less calories. And you can see here they live essentially 50% longer. Or when basically all of the rats that eat whatever they want are dead, essentially all of the rats that eat a little bit less are still alive. So it's a massive effect size. And over the last, so it was first observed actually almost 100 years ago. And over the last many decades, people have figured out that this is true for essentially any eukaryote where it's been rigorously tested. And this is probably the most robust and strongest way to extend lifespan that we currently know of. And we, despite many decades of research, we basically really have very little idea of what is the molecular mechanism that is leading to this, but presumably metabolism is involved somehow. And there are many other observations that suggest that changes in energy metabolism can really have a dramatic effect on health and longevity of organisms. And in my own lab, over the next few years, I hope to use some new approaches to try to contribute some new insights into how this works. And so we're using several approaches to try to do this. So, yes?
I mean, in evolution, you see organisms always fight for more food, right?
Yeah.
How is that to contradict this, right?
Yeah, so basically, to rephrase your question, like, how come eating less food makes organisms live longer? Shouldn't it be evolutionarily good to live longer always? And it's a... The answer to this question is, I think, well,
isn't unknown. Isn't what's evolutionarily important, reproducing rather than living longer? I mean, once you reproduce it, I guess, from a evolutionary point, you can live as long as you want. It doesn't really affect the population as a whole over a long time.
So.
Yeah. But presumably, if you reduced it from 40% to, let's say, minus 60%, it would go down again.
You will presumably go down a lot. Yes. Yes.
And so,
I mean, here, like the, for evolution, yeah, it's presumably the only thing that matters is to produce lots of progeny. And so, in this sense, in this case, the rats, the organisms, like rats or any other organism, they will produce a very large amount of progeny as soon as possible, as rapidly as possible. So there will be, if you look for some period of time, even though this live longer and can reproduce for a longer time, the red organism will win out always. It will produce many more progeny. So it makes, I think, some evolutionary sense that way. But there are, so you can, people have found mutations where you can mutate one gene and this will let the organism live twice longer. So then again, the question is, how come that happens? Shouldn't it be always advantageous to live long? And it doesn't appear to be the case. Like, if you're, just imagine if you are a mouse that gets eaten with a, like, approximately once a year. So then the point for a mouse to live 100 years is not obvious, because presumably you need to spend resources to live for 100 years. But if you are a bird, for example, and you can fly away from predators, then it's probably okay for you to have a lifespan much longer than a mouse, which is what people observe. And it's a, yes.
So what about the health and robustness and happiness of these?
Yeah. So essentially everything that we can measure, everything is better in the green mice. So for example, you can measure, so they are more active. You can measure things like depression in animals by basically you can drop mice in water and see how long does it take for them to give up swimming. And these mice are using that type of tests, and there are many others that are more sad, depressed, and unhappy. So if you are a calorie-restricted animal, everything is better, simplistically speaking. So reproduction is, so they make more progeny throughout lifespan, but there is like basically a peak of progeny production in the beginning if you're not calorie restricted, and it's more elongated if you are calorie restricted.
So if you want to plot reproductive rate per individual as a function of age in months for red and green, how would that work?
So I can draw a histogram. Hopefully that will be. So the reds will, let's say, look like this. This is number of progeny. This is time. And the green will look like this.
And the area under those curves is, how does it?
I think this is often bigger, but not by much. Often, the calorie-restricted ones will, I think, it's hard to say for sure. I am not familiar with any data that clearly shows that one is bigger than the other. So let's say approximately similar total number.
So the green curve means they were continuously fed the restricted calorie diet.
So it's the way that people do it practically is you just weigh how much they eat over here, and then you adjust. So over the lifespan, you often would adjust it somewhat.
And 40% miss of the normal.
40% of the red one, yeah.
So
40% less.
So for humans, this
not, not 40%, 40% less.
40% less?
Yeah.
So what is the prescription for humans? Like 800 calories per day, 1,000? I mean, there are people who do this experiment. There's this guy at South California who has been experimenting on humans, but sick humans.
It would be great to put people in a room and give them X amount of food. So that, because when you ask people how much they eat, people often misremember, and it's a difficult thing to study. But it basically.
Well, he does blood testing, and he claims that IGF-1 gets normalized or reduced, and there are some other parameters, blood glucose, that kind of
thing. Oh, yeah. Fasting has, there are many clinical trials that show can have tremendous health benefits. Yeah. But lifespan is a particular phenotype that takes a long time to measure for humans. So for humans, okay. Yes. I'm going to say last thing, and then we're going to
just wondering, do you know how lifespan is defined for yeast here?
So yeast, they divide asymmetrically. Mm-hmm. So you can separate a mother cell from a daughter cell. And so this is a number of divisions of the mother cell.
So number of divisions, not absolute
time. Not absolute time.
Okay, thanks.
And this is my last point. There'll be no questions for this last point. So this is the evidence for, so there's lots of evidence for humans of various sorts, but so this is now body mass index, which is your weight divided by your height square, and this is mortality, meaning number of people who died in X period of time. And so what people do is they would take a population of thousands of people, and then they would measure their BMI, and then separate them into two categories, on several categories, and then follow the population for a long time. And
right, what age?
There are many, many studies, various ages.
Okay, average over age. My BMI changed
a lot. People do these studies with many, many thousands of people, so you can subdivide it into however you want. Mm-hmm. And the way it looks like is, okay, so this is some level, and the way it looks like there is a little dip, and then it just goes like this, approximately. And so this level is your BMI of 21 to, let's say, 25. And then it just keeps rising. So if your BMI is, 30-something, then you have double the chance of dying during a particular period of time, etc., which is in favor is similar to that observation, suggesting that for humans it's probably.
But this seems to be complementary information. Let's say this guy Michael Phelps.
Yeah.
He claims he eats 4,000 calories per day.
Correct.
And then he goes into the swimming pool and he burns all of it swimming. But that's not the same as he doesn't eat more than 1,000 calories per
absolutely
day.
Absolutely correct.
He's working his yeah immune system.
But since this is, you know, tens of thousands of people, people like Michael Phelps are averaged out. And look, even a different example, like the NFL players, like yeah they have like, you know, 200 pounds of muscle instead of adipocytes. So then also,
what
it's going to be a bad example.
Michael Phelps probably falls in that low BMI range, but it doesn't mean that he might be like.
Yeah. Okay, this is the very last point. And this little dip, actually, if you remove basically smokers, then the dip basically disappears and it's like a straight line, indicating that this dip, this rise in mortality is presumably due to people who are already sick. And all right, I'm happy to talk for days about calorie restriction, but now we're going to talk about other things. And so the approaches that we use to try to say something about this is we develop new reagents to manipulate metabolism that I'll tell you briefly about. So this is basically the idea is to develop protein genetically encoded reagents to manipulate things like an NADH to NAD ratio, ATP to ADP ratio, etc. So that when we have an organism that is calorie restricted, and which means many of these ratios are changing in the same way in every organism, we can then come in, manipulate it, and see if changes in these crucial bioenergetic parameters are important for lifespan extension, for example. Then we apply. So we develop some of those reagents, usually in mammalian cell culture, because it's easy to do experiments there. Then we apply some of these reagents to C. elegans, because it's difficult. We want to do it in humans, but it's difficult for many reasons, including the fact that they live very long and it's tough to make transgenic humans. So for this reason, we do everything in C. elegans that live for 3 weeks. So it's easy to do large amount of experiments. And we built this scanning device to measure lifespan of many, many worms. And so the goal here is to try to figure out which of the many, many metabolic changes that are observed with calorie restriction are leading to the beneficial effects. And then finally, and this is what I want to spend most of the time talking about today, is we are trying to do some modeling of metabolic pathways to try to basically understand what are the important, how are metabolic pathways regulated. And so let's start with this approach. So why do we need new tools to study metabolism? And so this is my kind of simplistic overview of all of energy metabolism, which might already be kind of complex, I think, for this audience. But if you take things like calorie restriction or exercise, you have this bioenergetic ratios that are lowered. And the reason, and I want to focus on these ratios in particular, because they are basically master regulators of metabolism and physiology. So things like NADH to NAD ratio can regulate dozens of metabolic enzymes, can regulate ion channels, kinases, deacetylases, etc. Same thing with ATP to ADP ratio. There are dozens of metabolic enzymes that are directly regulated by binding of ATP and ADP to those enzymes, can regulate kinases, can regulate ion channels. It's actually the level of insulin in our blood is regulated by changes in ATP to ADP ratio in a specific pancreatic cell called beta cell. So it's, again, a parameter that basically regulates everything in metabolism. And so currently, it's very difficult to manipulate those parameters. So it's very difficult for us to study which of the phenotypes of things like calorie restriction or exercise or anything else that we observe are driven by changes in these parameters. And so this is what we're hoping to change. And the idea that we had is basically to use enzymes from some different organisms to do this. And the idea is that we'll be able to find an enzyme that catalyzes some reaction that, for example, changes NADH to NAD ratio, and ideally does nothing else inside of the cell. And kind of the advantages of this approach are pretty obvious. So since these are proteins, we can express them in any genetically tractable model organism, manipulate metabolism in vivo. We can express those enzymes at higher or lower levels. We can target them to nucleus or mitochondria or other compartments. and we can express them in specific tissues. And so in this way, we can manipulate bioenergetics basically in whatever way we want, in any compartment, in any tissue, in theory. And so to date, we've developed two such reagents, and this was my postdoc work. And so one such reagent is for lowering NADH to NAD ratio. So this is the enzyme called water-forming NADH oxidase. So many bacteria have this for reasons that I think are not clear. And what this enzyme does is basically takes NADH and oxygen and makes NAD plus and water. And so since oxygen, pH, and water are very well regulated intracellular metabolites, when we express this enzyme, basically the only thing that happens is we lower NADH to NAD ratio. And similarly, we mutated this enzyme to work with NADPH to NADP ratio. And so this is some evidence that indicates that this approach really works. So these are, I think, just HeLa cells. So this cyan and green means the enzyme is expressed, and the white bars means the enzyme is not expressed. So we can use this inducible promoter to do this. And so when we express this enzyme in either cytosol or mitochondria, you can see we lower the cytosolic NADH to NAD ratio twofold. And similarly, in the mitochondria, expression of this enzyme in the cytosol doesn't do anything, but only expression of this enzyme in the mitochondria lowers mitochondrial NADH to NAD ratio. And yeah.
I'm just curious, like how much have you fooled around with, like, asking as a function of expression level, how much of that impact do you have, and like how far can one push stuff in that regard?
Yeah, so we can change the expression of the protein over a large range by just adding more or less virus to cells. And so I think I would say threefold is the highest we were able to achieve. So we cannot express protein so much that it kills cells, for example. So I think we're limited by expression, but at the highest level of expression, threefold is as much as we can do. Yes?
So this is some kind of short-circuiting of the short-circuiting of this reaction. So how much does the flux of, say, NADH, NAD change when you express this protein? So I mean, is it changing it tenfold or twofold, or what is the? So that might be, that might be very relevant, because you might.
Yeah. So
that could be a major energetic short circuit in the cell.
Yeah, so for example, so some of the things that we did measure that I'm not going to talk much about, so we can measure the TCA cycle rates by use CO2 production. So that's for the mitochondrial enzyme, that can go up like threefold easily. And again, so it depends on how much enzyme we express.
Not very much then, so comparable.
But for the when we express cytosolic enzyme, almost nothing happens with the TCA cycle activity. And the only thing that happens is cells, instead of secreting lots of lactate to pyruvate ratio being like, let's say, 20, this ratio slightly changes and becomes like 10, and nothing else really happens.
But this is now metabolite levels that would change, you would say. But did the lactate excretion, did that change?
Yeah, so basically cells, they don't really secrete just lactate. They secrete a ratio of lactate to pyruvate as part of glycolysis. And so the thing that changes is you just have a slightly more pyruvate being secreted for the cytosolic enzyme.
So the TCA cycle actually is upregulated when you decrease NADH. So does that mean the flux increases by substantially? Is that
So like threefold,
Does that also mean the electron transport chain is also upregulated based on flux balance?
We don't see any. It's a little bit difficult to measure because this enzyme consumes oxygen. But when we acutely add electron transport chain inhibitors, there is no obvious difference in the activity, in the amount of oxygen consumption that is inhibited when we have or don't have the enzyme.
Oh, right,
so there is no dramatic change.
So it's harder. So you broke the flux balance, so you don't know what's happening with ETC.
Yeah, it's difficult to measure ETC, because this thing also consumes oxygen. Yes.
So to come back to my question again, you said the ratio between lactate and pyruvate that is excreted would change.
Yeah.
But would the rate of lactate and pyruvate excretion change?
No. No. No change. Yeah. Which is basically that means that things like electron transfer chain can adjust, or NADH supply for the electron transfer chain adjusts, so there is no changes in really ATP, ADP, anything as far as we can tell.
It's going faster?
Faster?
The turnover, whatever, the steady state is kept. But something has changed. You have changed the enzyme. So
yeah.
The energy barrier is lower, I suppose. So it becomes faster, which that new, so what has changed?
The NADH to NAD ratio has changed. The some of the pathways that make NADH are activated. Many, many, many metabolite concentrations have changed. The cell proliferation of cells is not affected at all. If anything, they grow faster sometimes.
Dennis, basic question. So, I'm sorry I missed if you said this, but do you have a simultaneous live reporter for the levels of every box in the cell?
Yeah, so we can measure it by cholesterol blocks, for example.
But
we measure the levels of that enzyme.
But as you're changing it in live cells, you're not simultaneously monitoring the levels.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, yeah. No, there are obviously many, 99% of other experiments are not shown yet. We know exactly how much enzyme we have. We've used several other techniques to measure NADH to NAD ratio. We do metabolomics. We know how every single metabolite changes, and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And just to put it in perspective with physiologically observed changes, with calorie restriction and with exercise, people observe changes of about twofold. So this is very much in line with what is observed in organisms. And then I'll just give you, so we applied it to do this reagent, to do several things, and we keep using it. Now I'll just give you one example of the thing that we found. And so we decided to study the function of electron transport chain that we've heard many times already today. And so everybody knows that electron transport chain is needed to make ATP. But what is less commonly thought about is that there are many other reactions that electron transport chain is essential for. And so previously, if you would see some phenotype as a result of electron transport chain dysfunction, it's actually impossible to tell whether it's due to insufficient ATP synthesis or due to inappropriate redox balance. And so with this reagent that we call albinox, we can, of course, uncouple the two, because albinox catalyzes exactly this redox balance reaction of electron transport chain. And so as a phenotype, we simply use mammalian cell proliferation, where so here, so you can take basically any, we tried many different mammalian cell lines. So these are HeLa cells where you add this drug called pyrrhicidin, which inhibits complex 1. So you can see there is no growth. And so this is a log scale, so straight line means exponential growth. And so now when we express albinox, and so remember albinox does nothing for your ATP synthesis. So there is no proton pumping, it's just this redox reaction. And so we can now completely rescue this phenotype. So basically cells in the presence of electron transport chain inhibitors and this protein grow exactly as fast as in the absence of electron transport chain inhibitors. And then we did many, 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 many other controls. We inhibited electron transport chain using many other drugs, and we can basically rescue rescue any of those drugs that inhibit electron transport chain. Yes?
I'm confused by this just because is this enzyme you're expressing membrane bound? Because it seems like what the rest of the electron transport chain is doing that's really crucial is proton translocation. So how are the, if you're inhibiting that, I don't understand how adding this other enzyme helps, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's the interesting part of this observation. That is not a membrane enzyme, it's just a soluble enzyme, and what this data sort of demonstrates that proliferating for mammalian cell proliferation, like nobody really cares about proton pumping or ATP synthesis by electron transport chain. Not nobody. Cells or ATP synthesis, and it's all about this redox balance, which is an interesting observation.
So presumably you saw that they started making more lactate, or are you saying?
They start to make more lactate if you, so presumably cells gets the majority of their ATP from fermentation in, when you inhibit electron transport chains. And cells, so this, like HeLa cells, for example, you can make calculations that gets 2/3 of their ATP from fermentation, even when electron transport chain is active anyways. So it's not really, and same as mostly true for average mammalian cell line that people commonly use.
And you need the redox balance to drive that reaction. So in some ways,
So that's as difficult.
So why is it bad? Like what links the redox balance to the growth?
Yes. So we know the answer to that question, and basically what it is if you look, so the way the cells are grown in culture. So there are several non-essential amino acids that cells can synthesize, and we often don't add those to the media at all. And so when you look at those pathways, so this non-essential amino acids, lipids and nucleotides have to be synthesized, and the pathways that synthesize them, you have to produce an IDH as a byproduct, which is usually great because you can use it for energy. But if you don't have electron transport chain, then you don't have a way to recycle this NADH back to NAD. And so all of those pathways become blocked. And other people have shown that you can actually rescue at the same time as we were describing this work. They showed that you can actually rescue this phenotype by adding very large concentration of aspartate, for example, to cells. And that sort of indicates that this inability to synthesize non-essential amino acids is the reason for this. Yes?
So what happens to the NAD pH levels? Because most biosynthetic pathways use NAD pH.
Yeah, nothing happens to NAD pH, NADP ratio. Yeah, we measured it. But so this, like for example, if you want to go from glucose to glutamate, you produce NADH. You don't use NADH to make stuff.
I'm thinking about
other pathways. Not much happens with NADPH to NADP ratio. Yeah. Which is also kind of interesting, where like how NADH to NAD and NADPH to NADP ratios are connected. And yeah. Yes?
Your question is, so presumably this immunogen synthesis, so they're happening in the cytoplasm, right? So I guess it depends most on the cytoplasmic NADH and NAD. So in that case, why is electron transport chain relevant here? Because you can do glycolysis and fermentation that forms a loop outside of mitochondria, right? So and so that related question is like, do you add LB-NOX? Do you add the mitochondrial version or the cytoplasmic version? Do both work? Do the rescue or one works?
Yeah. So both work. So this is cytoplasmic. This is mitochondrial. And some of the biosynthesis is happening in the mitochondria, of those non-essential, like aspartate and things. So, and the two compartments are connected through NADH shuttles. And if anything, the expression of this LB-NOX and the cytosol seems to work better. So for example, if you inhibit complex 3, it's harder to rescue. There is still no growth versus growth type of qualitative rescue, but the rescue is not complete, so the slope is not the same. But for the cytosolic, it is the same. And that's the hypothesis here is that because if you inhibit complex 3, you drop the levels of malate aspartate shuttle components, maybe it breaks down, something like that. All right, so this is all about that. Now I'm going to skip this, but we can come back to it later because I mostly want to talk about the other stuff. But the take-home message here is that we can mimic the effect of calorie restriction by these enzymes, and we can extend lifespan of worms somewhat, and it's work in progress. Happy to talk at length about that later. So now the main event is this modeling of metabolism. So the main question that we hope to do something about is basically, how do we know that we discovered all of the important regulatory mechanisms of a particular pathway? So for example, take a thing like glycolysis. So here, the green stuff is the positive allosteric regulators and the orange stuff is the negative allosteric regulators. And you can open any biochemical textbook and there'll be lots of arrows you open different textbook, there will be actually often usually different arrows, but some of the same metabolites repeat. And currently, I would say we basically have very little understanding of whether, for example, for the most, arguably the most well-studied pathway of glycolysis, if this is enough, do we need more, or maybe this is already too much. And so the hope here is how we want to answer this question is to basically build a model that will be able to recapitulate the behavior of glycolysis, and then we can understand better which allosteric regulator is important for what. And this is a collaborative project with Rob Phillips's lab, and Tal is a grad student in his lab who's now a postdoc at UW who started working with us on this, and Mangyu is a postdoc in our lab who is doing some follow-up experiments on this. And so the basic idea is the following. So you take some simple pathway where A is imported in the cell, converted into B, and then B is secreted. So you can write this kinetic differential equations to describe this pathway, where the change of this A extracellular over time is defined by this function F at X, and then that can be as simple as Michaelis-Menten equation, which is describing a similar simple enzyme that is not regulated, or it can be as complicated as you can imagine. And then to describe this whole pathway, you write this three more equations, and then all of these four equations, assuming that you know this, what are these functions describing the activity of each enzyme, assuming you know them very well, you can basically know everything you ever wanted to know about this pathway. And then if there is some regulation, let's say B is feedback inhibiting this enzyme Y, then all you need to do is to change these functions to be now a function of A and B. And so this is what we are doing. This is the basic idea behind this. And so we applied it to this fermentative glycolysis pathway. And so we chose this pathway for several reasons. So one is it's probably the most well-studied metabolic pathway, which means that we probably know a lot about what are the important allosteric regulators. Maybe we even know all of them. There is very good data describing the activity of every single enzyme in this pathway. And this pathway is also at least an order of magnitude more active than the second most active pathway, or often several orders of magnitude. So that means there are these little offshoot pathways here going from everywhere, and the hope is that we can ignore all of those things because they're quantitatively less important. And then also glycolysis, there is nothing left inside of the cell after fermentative glycolysis is finished. So glucose is taken up, two molecules of lactic acid are secreted, so there are no atoms of anything left inside of the cell. And the only thing that happens is you make ATP. And if you take a standard mammalian cell grown in culture, you can measure how much glucose is taken up and how much lactate is secreted, and the ratio is approximately 2-to-1 with an error for many cell lines.
So TCR is blocked in your model somehow?
So it's just proliferating cells choose to do this at a much higher rate than anything else, which is something that we talked about before, this Warburg effect, etc.
So yeah, in this plot, is there a branch off point, or is it just totally separate from the get-go?
So all of those pathways are here. So there is a pathway of, like, pentose phosphate pathway starts from here, like serine synthesis starts here, and the pyruvate can go into the mitochondria. But when you do a measurement on a whole cell, what you observe is that the ratio of lactate secreted to glucose taken up is approximately 2-to-1, indicating that the fraction of those offshoot pathways is small.
Those are the pathways that will be responsible for growth, right? So you have to be pulling some carbon into biosynthetic pathways if the cells are proliferating.
So mammalian cells, you give them all of the amino acids, they have everything. They don't have to synthesize many things from scratch. And many of the things they synthesize from scratch, they synthesize from glutamine in culture, for example. So, but even if this was the case, mathematically speaking, since you lactate secretion is double than glucose uptake, that means that the absolute contribution to this is minimal. So hopefully that means we can ignore it. Okay. And so then the inputs into the model is, so we need to pick some concentration, initial concentrations of metabolites. We can choose whatever we want just to start the differential equations, then we need to know all of the in vitro constants for every single enzyme and all of the equations describing their activity. And also we need to know the cellular ATP consumption rates, which is something that the model means, because the only product of glycolysis is basically ATP. So if nothing is consuming ATP, if your model is correct, glycolysis shouldn't be going anywhere.
And then you aren't getting any ATP from oxidative phosphorylation of other stuff.
Yeah, so we can inhibit it easily, okay, as I was showing on the previous slides.
But in yeah, this case, that it doesn't make a difference one way or another for those experiments which we're going to be describing. So
that's, I guess, another reason to use fermentation, because in mammalian cell culture, we can inhibit the electron transport chain, cells stay alive forever. So.
But I guess I'm just wondering, is that for what you're talking about? So
the model only contains this, okay, and so okay, the, yeah. Yes.
Can you take this pathway and get all of the enzymes and put it into a test tube and run this pathway just with all, completely reconstitute this pathway?
Yes. So I'm not going to talk about it, but yeah. So we set up a system where the whole pathway is reconstituted in the test tube, and we did it so that we can manipulate things that are difficult to manipulate in cells.
Yeah.
But so yes, that can be done. And we're not the first people to do it. There are several labs over the last many decades.
So that just proves that this really is all you need.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. This is all you need. Okay. And then the output of the model will be, if the model comes to steady state, which it should if it's real glycolysis, then you have rates of every single reaction and concentration of every single metabolite. And then you can also have dynamic changes from the initial values that you put in, that can be whatever you want, to the steady state values. And so many people have tried to do similar things. And
so Dennis, I know the flow, but I think the key point here is the feedback, right? So you have some metabolite feedback into controlling the enzyme.
Yeah.
So how many? Just this is all you consider, or this is all the known, feedback,
This is all that we included in the
model.
These
are the all known ones.
The whole point of this exercise is to answer this question. There are many, 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 many other things that have been proposed in various papers, some more accepted, some less. And the goal here is to figure out what is the minimal amount needed to recapitulate cellular behavior, and then maybe we can even remove some of these other ones and see what is their function. That's the goal of this whole exercise, is to figure out what are those feedback loops that are regulating this whole pathway.
Yeah, some actually feed forward, right?
Some are actually feed forward, correct.
How many steady states do you have in your model? Only one?
The model should decide whether it wants to come to steady state or not. So we don't.
No, just one steady state solution in your model.
If it decides to come to several steady, so far from what we can tell, it decides to come to one steady state.
One steady state.
But it's possible that it might decide to come to several steady states.
That's
a theoretical possibility. Yeah.
Going back to your earlier point, so we're essentially saying that you can completely consider mitochondria and cytoplasm as two completely different systems that are independent.
Yeah, even to make an even more dramatic statement, so we just consider this glycolysis as this thing that just exists in the cell, and everything else is so minuscule that we ignore it.
Yeah, energetically, in terms of ATP, you made a point, but connecting it back to your earlier study, where you showed when you inhibited or when you shortcutted the NADH oxidation, then you could not have growth. So that means that the protons, and you showed that it's not about the ATPase, but it needs to be the proton release into the cytoplasm. And that must be proton release, these protons that would come from the biosynthetic processes in the mitochondria.
I mean,
So that would be a connection where mitochondria and cytoplasm would be connected, but it could be that it's marginal, that this proton release, and that it would not have an effect on what's going on.
I mean, I guess a simple answer to your question, there are so many other things that we're not considering, that it's, if we observe something that is at all close to behavior of glycolysis in live cell, then we're onto something.
Yeah.
But, like, so in the previous one, technically what we showed is that lowering an ADH to NAD ratio is what is helping. There was no, we have no evidence that proton pumping is at all involved. But in the absence of electron transport chain activity, glycolysis can, for example, supply ATP for ATP synthesis to work in reverse to maintain the membrane potential, because it's likely that membrane potential is needed for, I don't know, existence of mitochondria maybe is required for cells. But
when you say PI, sorry, can you say PI inhibits something? What exactly do you mean?
So that means it binds to an enzyme and changes its allosteric properties in a way that on average it inhibits the reaction. It can be increasing Km, it can be decreasing Vmax.
So there's something that confuses me. So I believe you say that if I open another chemistry book, you will find a slightly different scheme for this big reaction. But then you are taking this particular scheme to construct your effective model. So do you have some evidence that these differences that you might find between different versions of the big model won't matter for your effective model? Or?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the point. Is we take some, we start from some random stuff that we feel is important, and then we see, does it work? Does it not? So we add some other stuff that other people consider important and see is better or worse.
From another one, would it have been? So you could do that, right?
I think that's a philosophical question. Yeah, we could have started from something else.
It's a practical one. You can try another.
But
yeah, okay.
But there are many other options. Yes.
Sorry, I was thinking that it's like that, like a little oscillations and stuff like that. Like, but you don't get that because you say you have a steady state. Or do you also see oscillations in this type of thing, in this model?
In the very last line, there are some oscillations, but I think they're not really compatible with living cells, so it's something else. But oscillations is an interesting thing that we constantly keep in mind to see if we observe oscillations under some conditions. And glycolytic oscillations are, it's a difficult thing. Like, you have to manipulate cells in particular ways. Like, often you would do, like, it's electron transport chain, then you have this dampening oscillations, and some of the original observations were in cell extracts. So it's kind of, it's not an easy thing to study because there is no agreed upon, you do this and you have reproducible oscillations. Everybody does it differently, period is always different, which is kind of weird. But it's something that we keep thinking about. Yes?
So, getting back to the whole motivation and asking, is this enough regulation to explain by observations? The observations here have nothing to do with growth. You're basically measuring
the observations here.
If I make a perturbation,
concentrations of intermediates,
how much lactate gets excreted? Yeah. So you're not saying that this might support enough NAD plus production to support making essential amino acids and growing.
We're just asking,
is this a good enough description of the regulation of glucose to lactate flux?
Yeah. So that's, we have really this model. Can this model predict the behavior of only this pathway in cells, is the question. All right. So there are many people have tried to do this. As far as we know, there is currently no single model of glycolysis like this based on in vitro kinetics or enzyme kinetics that can come to steady state under any conditions. Perhaps it's there somewhere that we didn't see it, or for any metabolic pathway. And it's not to be confused with like flux balance analysis, which is a very different thing. And so what we thought we can do differently is we can use this Rob's popularization of Mono, Weinmann, Shenzhou approach to describe the activity of enzymes in purple, which are the enzymes that, as you can see, they're regulated by many different things. To regulate the activity of those enzymes, to describe the activity of those enzymes better. And hopefully, maybe our model can come to steady state under any conditions. So, this is Mano, Weinmann, Shenzhou model. the idea, that's the thing we heard from several talks, and the idea here is that you basically imagine an enzyme as existing in this active and inactive state, and those two states would have different Km and different Vmax for the reactions. And so you can come up with this, I don't know, the constant that describing the ratio between the two under just basal conditions when nothing else is present. You can also think that there is some kind of regulator R that binds to a binding site. And this regulator will have binding constants that are different for the active and inactive state, or they can be the same. And then you can assign weights to this different things, and you can, from this, derive a bunch of very simple things. So, for example, in the absence of R, the fraction of E that is E active, which is really what we're after, is determined by this simple thing, which is just obvious from this definition. And in the presence of R, you get this slightly more complicated equation, but it's kind of, this equation is kind of interesting because that tells you that whether R is an activator or inhibitor is solely determined by the ratio of this KDs. So if the KD active is less than KD inactive, meaning that regulator binds more tightly to the active form, then it becomes an activator. As you can see, this will basically at high levels of R will become one, and then the other way around. So basically, using this simple idea, we can describe the behavior of various regulators that binds to the enzyme, and then they make it more active or less active. Okay, and so then I'm going to just give you one example of how we applied it to one of those really complicated enzymes. And so this phosphofructokinase is a tetramer. It has this at least three allosteric binding sites that bind various activators and inhibitors. This is the reaction that it catalyzes. The ATP is a substrate, but is also an allosteric inhibitor. And ADP is a product, but is also an allosteric activator, which is a very kind of confusing, interesting regulation. And this is the kinetics describing the activity of this. So this is not our data. This is data from the literature. And this is the beauty of studying glycolysis, where you can find great data like this. And so you can see that this is something that you cannot describe really with Michaelis-Menten kinetics. So for example, over here, so ATP is a substrate. As you increase concentration of ATP, you first are activated, and then you're fully inhibited. It's a very complicated regulation. Or in the presence of different effectors, you have this change in this effective Hill coefficient and other interesting things. And so basically, how can we come up with an equation to describe this? And so using only the ideas from the previous slides and this data, which is based on structural information, we can derive this type of an equation, which looks completely nightmarish. And I'm not planning to talk a lot about it, but we can talk for as long as you guys want. Not as long, but 10 minutes. So, but basically the idea here, you see there are these terms 1 plus concentration divided by KD, which is kind of the same as this term. There are five of those things because there are five binding sites. So this is 4. It's to the power of 4 because it's a tetramer. And then the things on the right is the active form, and the things on the left is the active form, and the things on the right is the inactive form, and they're connected by this term e to the minus energy, which basically is KD describing the ratio of the two. And then in the bottom is basically every combination of the enzyme with any site bound or not bound. And on the top, it's the same, except it's every combination where at least one subunit have both of the substrates bound to the active site, so which is supposed to be the active form that catalyzes stuff. Okay, so then we have lots of these constants, and we can use this data to measure all the constants.
I'm not sure about in Mamayas, but for example, I think bacteria, the ATP concentration is above, let's say, 5 millimolars.
Correct.
So that means that then this PFK is not working at the peak of the activity that you have?
Correct. That's exactly right. And it's almost completely inhibited under basal conditions. So you have to activate it to do anything, is the idea. Yes?
Sorry, that's a related question. Do you have a sense of for the so in vitro these are being changed over some massive range, Do you have a sense of, like, for the conditions you care about, kind of what's the relevant ranges of concentrations? Like, is it going to be changing over massive ranges?
So ATP, you mean basically? Well, so if I describe the concentrations of this, for example, inside of the cell, that would be...
Because hypothetically, I guess it depends on what you care about in the cell. So you could care about extreme conditions, you might not care about that, and you only care about stuff.
The range of values inside of the cell is kind of like here. Different cells, slightly different values. The fructose 6 bisphosphate is, I would say, below 1 millimolar as this standard range. The ADP is hundreds of micromolar, so it's somewhere here.
But then I guess this is just like the kind of thing I'm asking is that, I mean, like, maybe this is slightly a philosophical question, but like, one approach is, it sounds like what you're taking, where you're trying to get kind of like a description of the enzyme. Recapitulate all this in vitro data. Another possibility is to say, I don't really care about that. All I care about is how it's behaving in what I think the in vivo conditions are, and I'm just going to simplify it hugely.
Correct.
Yeah.
But how? Yeah, I mean, so that's, I mean, the in vitro, the beauty is that we have this data.
Yeah, yeah.
And then assuming, so we use kind of very simple logic and very simple idea and structural data to derive this equation. And then we can measure all these constants from this data and then hope that inside of the cell is the same. But it's just, so I don't, basically, I guess, how to measure the activity of this one enzyme inside of the cell, I think it's difficult.
No, I guess what I was saying was a little more simple. And again, you know, I mean, but like, so for example, like if you thought ADP concentration was always between 0.5 and 1, mm-hmm. maybe you say, oh, I don't need to capture this full sigmoidal behavior.
Yeah.
Everything's linear in there. I'm just going to throw in some linear term in my model, for example.
So I guess basically, like, the many talks that we've heard, like including yours, where people seem to be going in the direction of like, oh, we do this course models and they describe things, and here we're going exactly in the opposite direction.
Okay.
And I think that, like, to me, all I want is something that describes the pathway where you can have all the concentration of things that you can do then experiments to see if it's true or not. And I think what you're describing, the way I see it, would be maybe the next step where we can maybe use this as the springboard to simplify that, maybe.
But it's also true that what you're looking at, then the linearity between 0.5 and 1 for ADP,
that's
the presence of 3 millimolar ATP. And so it could be different.
Right.
And it is very different. Right. And
phosphate is different. Yeah. Right.
But the hope, when you, like, if you come up with, if you derive some equation that is real, and then you fit it under many conditions, the hope is it's going to even work under the conditions that, like, you measure these constants, and the hope is that it's going to work even under the conditions that you didn't measure in vitro, anyways.
So you're under, you, I mean, if you take this to the in vivo system, and, you know, your reaction does have ATP as substrate and ADP as product, but in the in vivo simulation, you just keep them constant. This reaction doesn't contribute to the balance between ATP and ADP, because that's controlled by
something
else.
Oh, it does. It of course does. That's the whole thing of the model.
But that's the question. Do you self-consistently solve for ATP-ADP concentration?
Of the model of the whole pathway? Okay. No, that's the whole point of the exercise.
So you keep them as some constant level. In your rate, you have the ADP concentration, the ATP concentration.
Yeah.
Are they dynamically changing
in
the model?
Yes.
And according to just the model, it's your model.
Yeah.
But there are other sources of ATP, ADP sinks and sources.
So that's going back to this idea of who's the more active manipulator of ATP and ADP, and the argument is that it's this.
So you're really solving it as a closed system. In your model, nothing.
It can't be completely.
I don't know about a closed system.
You're generating
system.
ATP. So.
But this stuff is all there is. This is all there is. There is a whole bunch of things that consume ATP, a whole bunch of things that produce ATP.
Yeah, but other than this, you don't have anything coming out from outside.
No.
Or going out.
So you have extracellular glucose, a whole bunch of intracellular things, and then lactate is secreted.
So there are no sources or sinks anywhere in the model.
Do you not?
So extracellular concentrations are fixed.
So the only quantities that are being fixed by some external chemistat are the
glucose and lactate. Extracellular glucose and extracellular lactate.
Sorry, I still don't understand. This generates ATP. That's the whole point of glycolysis. Well, it's ATP.
Yeah. Yes.
So there's got to be somewhere that goes in your model.
So there is this cellular ATPase consumes ATP, which is a sum of all of the life.
This is
the question. Come on, it's written here, cellular ATPase.
It's a little bit of a black box.
Yes.
What do you assume for a rate law for that? You assume it's just constant.
It's a Michaelis Menten enzyme. Michaelis Menten ATPase. Yes.
In your rate law, there was huge number of parameters. How many of them are actually identifiable given the data that you have?
Beautiful. Any other questions before we go on to that important question? Yes.
Can you go on? I'm just curious. Okay, now, presumably you're going to fit all of this.
Yes.
What all of the constants are.
Yes. And we see this, and there is no redundancy in any of the parameters, which is something that we worry a lot about. And for some of the other enzymes, so here, we assume the things are, you know, constants are positive and things like that. I think it's the only boundaries or however you want to call it. So for some of the other enzymes, where we will have some redundancy between the parameters, but often what we do in this case is, for example, here you have this curve in the presence of massive amounts of activator. It's fully active, basically. This whole right part will drop off, and there would be often redundant parameters, like one constant here and like some energy here.
So you're this fully, from a practical and from a structural point of view, fully identifiable?
So that, I don't know about the word structural.
Your equation, if there's two unknown parameters that would, for instance, be multiplied, there's no point that you could take them apart, that you could estimate.
Correct.
Them. Yeah. So that's what I would refer to structural identifiability.
In that case, yes.
Practical identifiability will be given the noise and the data that you have, the measurements that you get, can get two values for. Okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, we were very excited that that is true, because it's for that you need to have lots of data to make sure that this happens.
And is this an overdetermined system? It's an overdetermined system. I mean, you've got unknown parameters.
Yeah.
However many, 10 or something.
Yeah.
And then you've got data which also contains a lot of information. I mean, you're saying that you can determine all of the parameters.
Yeah.
But you have a lot more data, so you're determining them sort of over and over again. I mean, it's over-constrained system.
Yeah, so I think it's the same question. Yeah. So basically every constant here has a one unique value for this that describes this data. Yeah. It's not that you can, divide this energy by two and multiply this constant by two and still have the same fit. Like, that doesn't happen. Is what's my interpretation of your question is.
Do you have a lot more data to constrain?
If you left out a bunch of your data sets, could you fit the parameters on some data sets and then predict others?
Fit some parameters and predict others. So there are,
fit the parameters to some data sets, get a complete set of parameters, and then make predictions for other data sets that were not used.
Yes, so for example, here there are two different groups, so we can fit the parameters for data from one group, and then it describes the data from the other group. Is that?
Yeah, that's a good start.
Yeah.
Maybe this question is too hard to answer in a short time, but why hasn't this been done before? Like, what's new here fundamentally?
I think it's a great question. I don't know. That's.
Thing has been done.
There is no novelty here in any of the parts, I would say. Like this, like mono what, 50 years ago, he described this. It's just, so this enzyme is the mammalian phosphofructokinase is much more complicated than the bacterial one because it's actually a fusion of the two bacterial enzymes. I have many more regulators, but the principle, I think Mano would be able to derive this equation, probably, not probably, definitely. Of course, Mano would be able to, yeah. But, and then using differential equations to describe like kinetics of things, there is nothing new here. And it's,
so it's just no one has gotten around to this, or is there something from your experiments that you've learned that makes you believe that this model actually has a real possibility that people in the past couldn't see, so they never bothered to try?
Can I say something? I think it may not be a totally fair question. Because I would argue that the complexity of what you have put together from what I have seen is not very easy to put together and do the whole system.
Not very easy, yeah, but it's certainly there are people who can do it.
Because if you look at it from a chemical reaction perspective, without the biological aspects, people have done larger systems. Atmospheric chemistry is an example where they have done with hundreds of reactions. Plasma chemistry, thousands of reactions. So they have done it in different contexts. But putting it in the biology constraints is, I would say, relatively unique because it brings its own challenges because of the energy and the structural functionality is much more specific, unlike just plain chemical reactions. It appears to me. I'm an outsider speaking about how I see it. So I think it's not a very fair question to say uniqueness could be just synthesizing ideas together in a way, right?
Yeah, I mean, Okay, so let's see if anything actually works before we...
So I'm sure you've gotten this question before, but you know, Jim Zephna has this stuff about sloppiness and models of especially metabolism. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering whether or not this is, do you have a sense of, you know, is this model overcomplicated? Like, could you reduce the number of parameters in this model and actually still fit these?
So I think that goes back to Dan's question. Basically, maybe this is an overkill, and I think it's a very interesting question to basically, can we delete a whole bunch of things here because they don't matter and make it simpler? And I think, I assume the answer is most definitely yes, but...
No. the thing is, every parameter he proposed has a biophysical, biochemical meaning, right? It's a binding constant.
That's true.
I mean, you can make approximation by saying they are infinite. You just drop them off, or zero, then you just blow it up. You can only make approximation because their size are bigger or smaller than the but every parameter is meaningful.
Especially
not a fitting parameter.
That's what I wanted to say.
Biochemical parameters.
And evolution got us to this, right? So evolution generated a system where all of these things are binding, presumably, that was...
Yeah.
My question is not about the biochemical identity, but rather the influence of each one of these individual reactions in the overall scheme, right?
Yeah. I think that's a very interesting...
That's a scale question, right?
Yeah.
If your KD is 1 millimolar, then most of the concentration is zero, because if you're much smaller than millimolar, then drop it off. It won't ever bind, right?
Yeah, like basically, like Yuhai said, I think some of these parameters can be probably dropped because the KD is just so high that it's not as important, and which will simplify it, which I think is where you are getting at. And I think that would be interesting, but it's like we're...
Yeah,
I have to say, I'm not really interested in that. I don't know. Because for me, I have experiments, I can measure these things, as long as it reports things that I can measure, and then I can add remove various regulators to see how the things that I measure change, that's my end goal anyways. But I think to then figure out which of the things are really, really important in particular settings, I think it would be a very interesting thing to do, for sure. Yeah.
Can I ask one more practical question before moving on?
Yeah.
So all your y-axes are in arbitrary units. And so I'm curious how you're getting the v-maxes or k-cats or whatever.
Yeah, so they're just drawn here in arbitrary units, but the arbitrary units, just for fitting, it was easier to look at things when the one is basically Vmax, and we have the absolute value for Vmax from this data. Yeah. Yeah, so everything is in the end is in absolute units. But it only matters for these two parameters. So you don't have to, when you fit to find the binding constants, you don't care. Yes.
So it's a tetramer. How important is the cooperativity from being a tetramer important here? So there's some kind of a Hill coefficient that you use, is that?
So this formula is actually very general for, you can apply to any enzyme where you would, if you want to add one more binding site, you just add this one plus parameter. Yes. And the tetramer, because it's a tetramer, you have this to the power of 4. And if it was a dimer, it would be to the power of 2. And then this one is this n minus 1. So it's very important to have this type of things.
It's very
with
high
effective.
4 is important. Well, you get
that's,
three,
I think,
or
I don't know if we have enough data to say whether 4 is needed or whether 2 might be enough.
Okay.
1 is not enough,
okay. Yep.
For sure.
Okay, yep.
But 4, since the 4 comes from structural data, we feel totally fine using it.
Sure.
But maybe 3 is enough, because to the power of, like, it's, yeah.
Is PFK always a tetramer in all organisms?
I would say so. There are some, under some biochemical conditions, sometimes it falls apart into dimers, but it's believed to be inactive. All right. Okay, so now basically we have differential equations, we have this type of stuff, and we have constants for every single enzyme. So now what does the model show? So first, so this is just, so we, enzyme abundance is something that we need for the model also, the in the cells, because we have only kinetic constants. So we take enzyme abundance as just average of lots of proteomics data. And so this is the maximal enzymatic activity of various enzymes in our model, and everything is normalized to the least active enzyme, so it's easier to look at. But all of these values, we have absolute values of the maximal rate. And so what's one thing I want to highlight here is that, so this is a log scale, and so there are basically three enzymes that are least active. There's this hexokinase, phosphofructokinase, and this is a lactate transporter. A lactate transporter, it might or might not be true, because for proteomics, this enzyme and this enzyme are membrane bound, so they're likely, these values are likely underrepresented just because of the way data was generated. And so what's, you can immediately kind of make interesting conclusions here, that if you are, you know, an intelligent designer trying to regulate this pathway, you would probably want to regulate this enzyme and this enzyme, and this happened to be the enzymes that are most heavily regulated. And this is because, for example, if you want to regulate this enzyme, you know, you decide to inhibit glycolysis, you inhibit this enzyme by 90%, and that's still the most active enzyme in the pathway, so it will be zero effects of anything.
When you say activity, do you mean number or concentration, or what?
Vmax. If you make a lysate from a cell and you measure the absolute activity of every single enzyme with a perfect assay, that's what it would look like according to our model.
So it would be like Vmax multiplied by...
Vmax multiplied by... Well, Vmax technically has a concentration of enzyme in it. Kcat multiplied by concentration of enzyme, which is Vmax. Yeah. But so basically not just how fast can one enzyme go, but how fast can one enzyme go multiplied by how many enzymes are there.
And that assumes that all the allosteric regulators have been removed from your lysate?
Or it's under the conditions of maximal activity, yeah. The allosteric only allosteric activators are left. Mm. Okay. So, which is kind of
so
cool.
So those are presumably very reversible? I guess that's a question. The ones that have very high activity, are those the enzymes that are running reversible?
Oh, yeah. So the enzymes in purple are this irreversible Manol Weinmann-Shenzhou, and the rest are reversible Michaelis-Menten kinetics type of enzymes. So they go either way.
Question is here. So basically, the rate limiting step looks like MCT in this case, right?
Correct.
So does that depend on extracellular lactate concentration?
I'm not familiar with any evidence that this transporter is regulated.
So, okay.
Product feedback inhibition.
Yeah, but like, obviously, substrates and products affect the enzyme.
So, very naively, they say it's like basically the rate is determined by MCT. Is that.
Yeah, but if you think about it from a design perspective, that would be. So, there is no known evidence that this enzyme is heavily regulated, and that would be literally the worst step possible to regulate this pathway. Because if you want to shut down glycolysis, you shut down the last step, you have all of these metabolites that just fill up your cell with molar concentration, and then it's kind of, it wouldn't be ideal. So that's why another kind of design, I guess, principle of metabolic pathways, often the things are inhibited in the beginning. So you don't want to accumulate this massive amounts of intermediates of your pathway. So if you want to inhibit it, you might as well inhibit it from the beginning.
But is that what's actually happening? Because MCT is the really limiting step.
That's what is our current knowledge of how this pathway is regulated, so which you can kind of, by the number of green versus orange arrows, they are kind of here and here, and a little bit on this pyruvate kinase, which you can see here is, there's no real logic to regulate that enzyme.
Oh, so in other words, you want to have something upstream that has the activity comparable to MCT. So I'm a bit confused. It's like, because MCT is the rate limiting step in here, but unless there's something lower than that upstream, then that would be the regulator.
So two points related to this. So one is, since these two are transmembrane proteins and the data is proteomics data, it is likely that the amounts are underrepresented here, so it's probably higher. And the second point is, this enzyme and this enzyme, as somebody pointed out, they are under physiological conditions, they're inhibited by their allosteric inhibitor. So in reality, this is Vmax, but inside of the cell, this is inhibited by 90-something percent, making it even lower.
How many of these enzymes are actually saturated versus operating in a linear range, because these are all values assuming every enzyme is saturated.
Yeah, so I don't know off the top of my head.
Could be much lower if they're not saturated.
Correct. I don't know off the top of my head how many of them are saturated. Yeah.
There may be also a role for just simple lactate diffusion over the membrane.
We have no parameter like that, but it's a. Yeah, that's a theoretical possibility for sure. Yeah. But yeah, we don't have lactate diffusion, something to think about.
Are we supposed to see an upward trend? Is that the idea?
No, you're not. All you're supposed to see here is that these two things are super heavily regulated and also seem to be least active. So it's such a beautiful logic of regulating this pathway.
I think the sequence is actually pretty bad, right?
All right. The fact that these things are kind of more active than these things?
No. The horizontal axis. These are the enzymes.
Oh, these are enzymes in exact sequence. So
right,
it's
right,
first,
right.
Second, third, blah, blah, blah.
Right. So
yes.
You're saying in the beginning you want
to... If you want to inhibit something, you might as well inhibit in the beginning, logically speaking, I think. Unless you have some use for the intermediates. And that's why presumably there are two, because the products of this can be used for pentose phosphate pathway, glycogen synthesis, etc. Okay, we're moving forward. Okay, so now I'm going to give you two examples of how the model results look like, and then I'll tell you about how the model behaves under any condition imaginable. So our simulation is basically, this is the usual start points. Basically, all of the intermediates are basically zero. You have extracellular glucose that is 5 millimolar, and actually, the extracellular lactate is zero, and these are some initial values for the cofactor concentrations, basically nothing really unusual. So then, and then I'm going to show you this data in percent of theoretical maximal, because so we know that pathway cannot go faster than this MCT, and so that would be, that's the percent of theoretical maximal. And we won't really go through all of these enzymes here, but the important part here, so this is the rate of every single enzyme and the pathway in absolute units, and the red is the ATP consumption rate. And so what you can see here is that there's stuff happening, some stuff gets overactivated, and then this is, 5 minutes? So all of the action is kind of done after 1 minute or so. and then it comes to steady states. And the thing that you can see here is the enzyme. There are enzymes whose activity is equal to the ATPase rate, and then there are enzymes whose activity is half the ATPase rate. And this is because over here, the glycolysis basically duplicates, and so all of the enzymes here in steady state will be twice more active than all of the enzymes there, and that's what we observe. And then this is just to give, so this is the same absolute scale. So now it's 80% of maximal rates. This is what you see. So the red bar is now much higher, and so the things have to be activated much higher. And you can see this is a strangler, the lactate transporter, which takes a few more minutes to actually come to steady state. So that's that. Then, yes?
If you simulate metabolite levels, would they be consistent with the metabolome measurements for steady
that's
state?
So these are metabolite levels, but I'm going to get to your question in two slides, I think. So the metabolite levels are, so you can see, so this is six orders of magnitude of concentration. I apologize that it's so pixelated, but it doesn't really matter. But basically, so this is the same time scale. So you can see that as far as changes in metabolite concentrations, basically after only tens of seconds, you don't see much happening, which is very much consistent with the fact that it's very difficult for us to experimentally determine any changes in glycolytic intermediates, like dynamic changes. It's just stuff is too fast.
But with those numbers, now, if you believe them, you could go back and look at KMs and you could figure out who's saturated and who's not.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. There's, yeah, we have that information. I just didn't know. Yeah. Yes?
There's also lots of isotope labeling experiments so you can definitely measure turnover rates from pools. So
correct.
You can predict
correct.
That.
Yeah. Correct. Now there are lots of, lots of options like this. And it's okay. So now, basically, various summary data. So basically, what do we, if assuming the model works, like how will we know? So it should come to this steady state under many, many conditions. While it's at steady state, it should maintain this high, this energy charge like parameter. So basically, most of the ATP pool should be in the form of ATP. And then it should predict reasonable concentrations of metabolites that are similar to what we see in experiments. And then another thing that I didn't mention here, then presumably the model should come to steady state under close to 100% of theoretical maximal rates, because otherwise, evolutionarily, that means you're wasting things, wasting enzyme levels. Okay, so this is basically the sum of many, many plots from the previous slides that basically shows the enzyme rates relative to this lactate transporter and rate of this ATPase. So you can see everything falls onto this two beautiful lines, except this cyan enzyme is this fructose bisphosphatase. It's like we should probably delete it, but it's kind of this enzyme that goes in the reverse here, which is important for gluconeogenesis, but it's expressed everywhere for some reason. So that's why, since it's not real glycolytic enzymes, it's basically zero always. And so here again, so the green is the line that is not plotted through these dots. This is the line that's plotted independently, which is x equal to y, and the red is x equal to 0.5y. And so again, as I was mentioning in the previous slides, basically all of the enzymes fall into two categories. One is exactly the same as the rate of ATPase activity, and the other one is half, which is exactly the stoichiometry of glycolysis. And we don't tell the model anything about it, which is just a bunch of enzymes together that figure out that they should do this by themselves.
Wait, I'm a little confused, but like, doesn't that have to be the case if you're at steady state? Like, isn't that like...
Correct.
Yeah, correct.
But So this is the first example of any model of glycolysis or a metabolic pathway that comes to steady state. So that's basically the evidence that it comes to steady state under this many conditions. So this is two orders of magnitude of ATPase rate. Yeah.
So another thing is, so under what circumstances the model does not reach steady state? How can it fail, for example?
So if you go to 90%, it doesn't work anymore, so it cannot keep up with ATPase activity. 90, yeah.
That's the bifurcation to the TCA, you think?
Yeah, I don't have anything. To look, but like, since there is no TCA, it doesn't matter. But that transport chain activity can kick in theory and provide an additional ability to make ATP for sure.
But it could also be instances where the cellular ATPase rate is so high that cells would change their protein expression.
Right.
Yeah, presumably, if you're a cell, then right. If this happens, you just shut down translation, shut down everything, and you just hang out there, try to survive.
So in your regulation, what is called the feedback, there's no protein production, no enzyme production.
There's no enzyme production, okay. Correct. Okay. Because we can do measurements rapidly.
That's
a
short time scale.
Yeah. In a scale where processes doesn't matter. Yeah. Yes.
If you took the ATPase rate higher, then why wouldn't it reach a steady state?
So at some points your ATP consumption rate is higher than the maximal rate of this transporter, and then
I think it's a total.
You cannot reach,
like,
basically,
you can't generate ATP.
There is an absolute limit to how much ATP you can generate from a pathway because we have absolute values of everything. So when you go past that level, then you cannot reach steady state because this pathway cannot even in theory go so fast.
But I think you said it fails before 1.
It fails before 1. So it's not completely perfect.
So why is that? Let's say if there's no feedback.
So if you artificially increase lactate transporter, if you double its Vmax, then it goes like 99% is fine. Hundreds doesn't.
Does that just mean that ATP falls so much that you can't even get to the first step, so everything just shuts down?
Correct. Not the first step, but eventually everything just shuts down. Yes. There is no ATP for the first step. And.
But that is a steady state.
Oh, that's fair enough. It is a steady state.
Okay. So there's a
I don't count it as steady state because it's not a steady state that's compatible with a living cell. But so, technically, you are never mind.
So in other words, it's this feedback, this allosteric regulation that make you break before 1.
No.
Otherwise, like if everything is everything linear.
I guess. Yeah, theoretically, yeah, it must be.
Yeah, otherwise you can reach 1, right? It sounds to me like like non-linearity, which is because that is a regulation that just works.
Yes. Okay. So can we maintain energy charge that is high? So these are here you can see what happens at 90%. So this is hours of simulation, and you can see this red line is just like drops here to 0, even though it's. As was pointed out, is at steady state, the energy charge is basically 0, there is no ATP. So that's bad if you're a cell. And then, but then even at 80% of this theoretical maximal rate, you maintain this almost respectable energy charge of 60%. And here, so from here to here, so this is 80-fold difference in the ATP consumption rate, and the energy charge only changes from like 60 to 95%, which is kind of exactly like glycolysis works. And then the final there is, can we what are the concentrations of metabolites that the model predicts?
So can you go back to that, because that's a very important point. So what you're saying is that this model predicts that the phosphoryl potential, if you like, you know, the ATP ADP ratio is incredibly robust, so really only a factor of 2. Well, from 60 to 90,
like a little bigger, but
even less than a factor of 2. So it's very, very, it's clamping the ATP-ADP ratio very, very closely.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people have say, you know, well, enzymes are regulated by the ATP concentration. ATP is intracellular ATP is a major regulator in cells, and I've always just thought that's just bullshit. But this is evidence that's not the case.
Yeah. So that to the power of 4 is very important. Very important to achieve that, presumably.
Anyway, would not be a good regulator.
But basically, you often hear of metabolism. People say like, "Oh, who cares about ATP and ADP? They never change." But since you only need, like. For them to change by 2-fold to activate the pathway 10 times, then that's kind of helps to explain that.
So, okay. But following the energy charge, some people say adenine kinase, which is an enzyme that regulates energy charge. Is that relevant in here, or are you basically also providing a hypothesis where it does not need that kind of regulator for energy charge to be kind of, you know, close within a certain range? And they say adenine kinase is close to equilibrium. So I'm always confused by that point.
I'm thinking whether to draw. So adenyl kinase is not important at all for maintaining ATP charge. So it's, well, no, I'm not going to draw it. So it just catalyzes this reaction of two ADPs, make ATP plus AMP. It's so active, it catalyzes this reaction to basically close to the equilibrium constant of that ratio, which means there is no energy to be gained. All it does is just sets up the ratio between those things for it to be useful for allosteric regulators like this.
So then the point is, so there, the ATP, ADP, AMP would want to be a certain ratio because it's close to equilibrium. And then you predict another ratio here. Are they compatible?
So technically, yeah, I forget if AMP is... So when in other versions of the model, when we do have a regulation by AMP, we do include the adenylate cyclase. But here, I think that it must be here also. So then they are compatible because it's there. Yeah.
I'll ask another question. That is, so what happens to the ATP concentration?
Beautiful segue to my next slide. So basically, is this true? This is how the data will be presented. There is a box that covers a range of values that are observed in our measurements on red blood cells, and measurements, just metabolomics measurements in cell culture. And then the dots are basically various predictions of the model under various percent of maximal activity. So you can see a bunch of predictions are in the box. These are many other levels of metabolites where, again, a bunch of predictions are in the box. And then these are all levels of all of the intermediates where, so for glucose, we actually don't have measurements, but it's basically almost equal to extracellular glucose concentration. And then basically for most of the metabolites, the measurements that the model predicts are very similar to what is observed in live cells, but there are some interesting exclusions where one can make all kinds of arguments about who is right, or I like to make arguments whether the model or experiments are right, because model predicts free concentration of metabolites, and as we heard before, free and bound can be two very different things. And so if, for example, the glycolytic enzymes concentrations are about here, so if every enzyme has a metabolite bound, then this should be much higher. But basically the take home message is, it seems the model seems reasonable, it does what glycolysis should be doing, produce concentration of metabolites that are reasonable, and now we are doing lots of follow-up experiments where we take one particular cell line, we super carefully measure absolute concentration of every single enzyme, and then we activate or inhibit ATP consumption of the cells to basically see whether we can predict changes in this pathway when ATP consumption is activated or inhibited, and how well can we describe this. And just one last thing is, what can we...
Let's go back to that.
Yes.
So the ATP concentration is maybe changing by a factor of 2 or something.
Yeah.
And consistent with experimental values.
Like 2 between like really extreme cases.
Your predicted ADP levels are really a lot higher than the measured ones, like in muscle, for example, 100 millimolar ADP, and even less in other systems. So I'm surprised that you're almost an order of magnitude.
Yeah. So muscle is an interesting. So there are, of course, these enzymes like PFK. There are different genes that code for. So they have different KMs. So we don't include the muscle enzyme here because we use the isoforms that are from proliferating cells. But if we would include the muscle, it would lower some of those parameters. But muscle also have this creatine kinase keeps it feeling more
down. ADP is really the biggest discrepancy that you've got almost.
I guess you're also only using one protein, one enzyme concentration, right? You could ask yourself, how would you need to adjust your protein, your enzyme levels, in order to get your model predicting incremental metabolites better, and then you could go and ask, is that really an altered enzyme expression pattern under high ATP load?
Yeah. I think like we need to do more, because some of this data is generated from cells where electron transportation is not inhibited, so it's we need to generate more data to even know if we're really off or not, and then figure out why. Okay, and the final, I mean, I'm already over time, but just example, okay, what kind of cool stuff can we learn? So you open Leninger and or any other biochemical textbook, this phosphate positive regulation is almost never there, and phosphate is considered this boring thing that never changes inside the mammalian cells anyways. And so we can, with the model, we can ask, okay, what happens when we remove this phosphate regulation? So this is a model with phosphate, and then when we remove positive allosteric regulation by phosphates, model can only come to the steady state that's compatible with life at 1% of the maximal activity. So things dramatically break down, indicating that this positive regulation by phosphate is essential for this pathway.
So that's very interesting. I mean, that's one possibility, but isn't another possibility that maybe, like, if one was being very skeptical, that, you know, you got the other parameters from in vitro stuff, and it could be that you know, in vivo, because of the other things, the relevant parameters of enzymes could be quite different. And so perhaps one could wonder if maybe if you had used other parameters, you wouldn't have got that effect if you removed this.
Correct. It's a theoretical possibility. Yeah. No, if our assumption is the in vitro.
That's the thing which you can investigate. Right?
Yeah. So that's why we made that cell-free system that we were talking previously about, because you can't really drop phosphate to zero inside of the cell. So we have this cell extract that can do the whole glycolysis, where we can now go and manipulate these phosphate levels and see if this is indeed the case in that system, which is not in vivo, but...
But perhaps another way to ask the same question is that, like, if you assume you're going to have some uncertainty in your parameters, and then you could start asking, well, like, you know, how much if you vary the parameters, some, do you get the same results or not, or is stuff sensitive to that or not?
I mean, I'm not sure. Yeah.
This is an interaction he introduces. It's very hard for me to imagine. You change some parameter, you maybe rescue some of these curves, but like to change the overall behavior.
I don't know.
Maybe,
I don't know
how
you can say that. You know?
But
it's a thing to do to answer you, Dan. You check the prediction of the model, and if it's
true
or it's not.
If you
mess with the phosphate, you don't get any effect. Then what you're saying is probably correct.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that it's. I don't know.
It's just that this is a mechanism for sort of adaptation or maintaining some. I mean, the ratio is being maintained, right? So I think this effect is probably more qualitative than quantitative. I mean, you show the difference, but the qualitative difference is that with this interaction, you saturate to a constant level. That constant level is dependent on the demand, but the other curve just dies, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's a very qualitative difference. I don't think you can change parameter and achieve qualitatively different behavior in the range of parameters.
But presumably it has to do with how much the concentration of PI changes under different circumstances. I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't see how you can conclude that.
Yeah, concentration of PI changes can change quite a lot. Like in muscle, people can do this, NMR type of studies. But I think that applies basically to all of the results of the model. And so this probably is the hardest thing to address in any way, because we can't manipulate really phosphate levels and so on. But for many of the other things, the way I plan to interpret things is if the model recapitulates the direction in which metabolites are changing and the levels are within 95% confidence interval, that means whatever the model contains is probably how it works. But the more various evidence we get, the better, I guess. And the very last slide to go now in the opposite direction, there is this other super famous enzyme that is in every single textbook, which I didn't talk about, is going to show up here. And this enzyme, all it does is it's produces this metabolite whose only function is to activate this enzyme, which already has a bunch of activators. And so, same thing, so we have this, and then when we incorporate this enzyme, we observe something kind of strange, and it's a... So oscillations where your energy charge drops below 20% are presumably not something that happens in cells, because I think they won't survive. But what you can see is nothing is better, and this thing is flipped. So now, when you go fast, you can maintain steady state, and under 80%, then maybe it's even a little bit better, assuming higher energy charge is better. But then under every other setting of the rate of ATP production, it's just worse, and worse. If so much so that at 1% rate, you're basically at essentially zero, which is kind of, which tells you that there is no major benefits of this enzyme in our model. And I think the interpretation here is that I think this, the true role of this enzyme is actually to overrule this regulation by ATP, ADP cofactors, because, for example, you sometimes need to make pyruvate to make fat, for example, in adipocytes. And if your adipocyte cell have high ATP to ADP ratio, then that pathway is inhibited. You need something to overrule this regulation. And presumably this enzyme does that. And that's something that we can easily test, and we're doing it in cells by deleting this enzyme.
Is PFK-FB known to be inducible or regulated under a particular study environment?
Heavily regulated by hormones, hypoxia, other things. Yeah. But, yeah.
Yes, let me tell our proteomics friends that come with tons of post-translation modifications that have a role in...
Yeah. The evidence that post-translational modifications modify the activity of metabolic enzymes, like, there are textbook examples, but beyond that, some of the data that you see is very, 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 very subtle. So, like, some of the... this regulation by this ATP, ADP can change activity of enzymes by orders of magnitude. Some of when people purify like phosphorylated versus non-phosphorylated enzyme, it's like a, can be like a 30-40% change, which is for biochemists is that's you just put a star, non-significant, and you move on. Hopefully there are not too many proteomics people. But okay, that's it. This is my acknowledgement. Our mini lab, collaborators, funding, and this was not supposed to be here, but you can see I'm looking for those.